This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So the latest numbers on consumer confidence tell us you're not very optimistic about the economy these days. What we all seem to need is a little reassurance that things are going to get better. Well, how about this from White House Press Secretary Dana Perino today?
It's going to take a while, and we've been very careful and cautious to make sure that we tell people there's no magic wand that anybody can wave.
In other words, hang in there. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Brand Week, the news organization dedicated to the information needs of strategic-minded marketing executives with real-time coverage, now searchable at brandweek.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Hope you're holding up under the pressure on this Tuesday, the 24th of June, because it's not really hard to understand why consumers are more than a little rattled these days. Just take a look at the gas pump, for starters, and then all those worrisome headlines today. Home prices keep sliding, prices everywhere else, it seems, keep rising, and the economy is still on the edge. Consumer confidence has skidded to its lowest level in more than 16 years. But what's really unsettling is the Conference Board's monthly index of consumer sentiment was 6 points lower than economists expected. What gives? We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to find out why we consumers are singing the blues.
Even in downtown Washington, just blocks from the White House, consumers feel insecure. Take engineer Peggy Vanderpool and paralegal Dean Yorgi.
The prices are going up on everything while the economy is doing poorly.
Then gasoline causes higher prices for everything else, the food, and, you know, people losing their jobs over it. It's really sad.
Yorgi and Vanderpool are both cutting back on their spending, purging their budgets of non-essentials and unnecessary travel. Everybody's worried about gas prices. They hear about investment banks' troubles. Home equity loans are just a pleasant memory. Unemployment is over 5%. But hey, it was worse in the 70s, and we had disco music on top of everything else.
We had an impeachment, a very deep recession. And yet, I don't think the consumer sentiment readings were much worse then than they are now.
That's William Hummer, chief economist at Wayne Hummer Investments. He says we don't have 70s-style inflation or unemployment now, so why do we feel so bad? The usual suspect, the media.
What's going to make or break the markets today? We'll be back.
Jonathan Basile is a Credit Suisse economist.
And there are many more outlets for different financial news. And I think the general public is a little more aware of it and can feel worse about it, especially when the news gets worse.
Basile says it'll take a few years for consumers to start feeling better. But at least in the meantime, we don't have to listen to disco music. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We already mentioned the record slide in home prices. What we didn't tell you is that prices fell so far in the past year that they're now where they were in 2004. 3 years of gains down the tubes. Which raises the question, is this the bottom we've all been waiting for? From Miami, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Housing prices nationwide plummeted 15% in the past year, a new record. Bubble towns fell sharpest. Las Vegas and Miami led the nation with freefalls of 27%.
other downturns in the home market in the past seem relatively minor compared to this. What we're seeing here is an unprecedented market.
Maureen Maitland is a vice president at Standard & Poor's, which publishes the Case-Shiller Index. Prices were down in all 20 major markets surveyed, including Charlotte, North Carolina, the last holdout.
The fact is, we're seeing it nationwide, so there's no one market that's holding up another to keep the national average higher.
Some areas, like Chicago and Denver, saw prices rise slightly in April compared to March. But if you're thinking this could be the bottom, you're a little early. Jack McCabe runs a housing research firm in South Florida.
The folks that want to call a bottom right now are calling a false bottom, and they're usually vested interests that want to see the market turn as quick as possible.
Most experts think home prices will keep falling through 2009. Charles R. Morris is author of The Trillion-Dollar Meltdown.
Most analysts now think that the home price fall will be 25 to 30%. That would mean we've got another full year of this kind of drop yet to go.
Morris says this is payback for a 12-year bull run in the housing market. In Miami, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
The nation's largest cane sugar producer plans to sell a huge chunk of the Everglades to the state of Florida. The state announced today it'll spend $1.75 billion on the land, which is currently owned by U.S. Sugar Corporation. The company, which accounts for 8% of the nation's sugar production, will abandon its business entirely within 6 years. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
Standing in front of the Loxahatchee National Wildlife Refuge, Republican Governor Charlie Crist made the announcement today.
This represents, if we're successful, and I believe we will be, the largest conservation purchase in the history of the state of Florida.
It was certainly a win for environmentalists, says Kirk Fordham, who heads the Everglades Foundation. Sugar companies are said to be among the biggest polluters of the Everglades.
Oh, this is something that the environmental community has been fighting for decades to acquire.
For the sugar industry, today's news was bittersweet. Ryan Weston is with the Florida Sugarcane League.
If you've been to that area of Florida, you know that Clewiston is known as a sugar area. You know, their football field is a cane field, and everything around that entire area is really devoted to sugarcane production.
Still, unlike other commodities, sugar prices have remained flat, so farmers can't reap the kinds of profits available in other crops.
Sugar is about the same price it's been for the last 20, 25 years.
U.S. Sugar's Senior Vice President Robert Coker says the eventual shutdown of U.S. sugar 6 years from now won't put a huge dent in the 8.5 million tons of sugar produced domestically each year.
You'll see private capital and you'll see private investment go in different places, and the marketplace will make up for it.
Do you plan to stay in the sugar business after the end of U.S. sugar?
At the end of the six-year reservation period, I'm going to be sending out a resume because I'm going to need a job.
That goes for the company's 1,700 other employees as well. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Wall Street investors weren't any more confident today than the average American consumer these days. Stock prices lost more ground today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. After all that discouraging economic news we topped the program with, now we turn to a place where business is booming, China. Is it possible we could learn something from the Chinese? They seem to think so. After all, we've been telling them what to do for quite a while, but now, guess what? They're pointing their fingers right back at us. Our China Bureau Chief Scott Tong is back in the States for a quick visit, so it's a good time for a chat about this. Welcome, Scott.
Hi, Bob.
So what are we talking about here with all this finger wagging?
Two things. Principally, one is the subprime crisis, and the problems in America are obviously affecting China. The more problems Americans have, the less stuff they buy, and we all know where this stuff comes from. So we know the export sector in China is taking a hit. Issue number two is the dollar and currency. For the longest time, members of Congress and Treasury Secretary Paulson have been screaming at Beijing to lift the value of its currency, which many think is artificially low. And China's response has always been, we're going to control it nice and slow and make sure things don't get out of hand. And so now they're saying, look at the dollar. It is getting out of hand. And it's affecting us too, because the dollar is connected, according to many, to inflation. And that's issue number one in all over Asia, China and Vietnam and the Philippines. So China is worried that what they consider Washington's mismanagement is having ripple effects all the way out there.
So where is all this headed? Is this just a philosophical debate, or is it more than that?
Well, it's a lot of rhetoric right now, and the pattern has been when Washington is perceived as proselytizing about how to do things, it devolves into this playground equivalent of I'm rubber, you're glue. and we've got kind of that situation now, and China is feeling kind of proud now. Their system, you put them next to each other, China's looks a little better right now. And China's hosting the Olympics, and they're feeling proud of what China has accomplished. And rightly so, according to many. I mean, the economy is the number four economy in the world right now, and it's about to pass Germany as number three. And it came out of nowhere exactly 30 years ago when the economic reform started.
So what's China's interest in this? Are they pushing some kind of agenda?
Some people in Washington think China is, that there is kind of this alternative economic model that China has and is trying to export into different parts of the world. The people I talk to in China tend not to buy that. They say if there's any agenda or grand plan in Beijing, it's pragmatism. Deng Xiaoping, the former Chinese president who is the architect of the modern Chinese economy, was said to have said, it doesn't matter if it's a black cat or a white cat, so long as it catches mice. In other words, so long as we get rich, we're going to kind of feel our way and see if this works, and if it doesn't work, try an alternative approach. So for all this rhetoric, most people think China is just moving in the same direction that Washington wants it to go. It's just going to go at its own pace.
But you know that there have been a lot of complaints here that it's going too slowly. What's the danger that this could escalate into protectionism, let's say?
Well, there's talk of protectionism in Congress, that China isn't proceeding quickly enough. From China's perspective, the technicians who are trying to tweak the economy, most people tell me that this pushback rhetoric right now, at least, is not going to lead into protectionism from the Chinese side, that what motivates them principally is political stability. And if they can go in the right direction in a way that's politically stable, they're going to keep going in that direction. And for all the rhetoric and finger wagging globally, it's going to be motivated by domestic concerns first.
Our Shanghai Bureau Chief Scott Tong giving us the view from over there today, joining us in Los Angeles. Thanks, Scott.
All right, Bob. Nice to talk to you.
You may recall that back in 2006, the Nobel Peace Prize was shared by a bank. Grameen Bank is a Bangladeshi institution that's practically synonymous with microlending. It provides small loans to launch businesses and help people lift themselves out of poverty. The bank's been operating throughout the developing world for decades, and this year it opened up shop in America. But financing a business in the U.S. costs a lot more than financing one in, say, Bangladesh. Marketplace's Alisa Roth has been looking into whether the model can really succeed here.
Amparo Cataño's living room is filled with cartons overflowing with undergarments. They're on wire shelves that line the walls and piled chest high on the floor. She's been selling underwear and other products door to door and in flea markets for years. But a few months ago, she decided to go into business for herself, importing stuff directly from her native Colombia. She applied for a loan from Grameen and got $3,000. Grameen America is trying to replicate what it does abroad, requiring lenders to borrow as part of a small support group. And so it is that a dozen or so Latino women are squeezed into Amparo's living room turned stockroom, making their weekly loan payments. To recreate its model here, Grameen's found the developing world in New York. Most of its 250 or so borrowers are immigrant women living below the poverty line in Queens. But unlike, say, Bangladesh or Bolivia, money doesn't go very far in New York. Ritu Chatri is vice president of Grameen America.
Number one is some of the businesses are home-based.
So they're not dealing with overhead costs like rent or electricity.
And the second point is this is the first loan cycle. They know that they can have increasing amounts of money in each successive loan cycle.
Grameen will lend more to borrowers if they repay the way they're supposed to. The organization's often credited with starting the microfinance revolution in the developing world, but it's a latecomer to microfinance in the U.S., which has evolved in a very different way. One organization that's reinvented itself in the U.S. is Acción. It's been here for decades and long ago tweaked its original model to fit the needs of borrowers here. One of the things it realized is that microloans don't have to be startup money. Their average loan is now around $8,000, probably not enough to get a business off the ground, at least not in New York City.
What it enables a business person to do is remain stable.
That's Gina Harmon, CEO of Acción New York in New Jersey.
It pays for an awning on a bodega, an additional machine in a bakery. It can pay for an accountant to buy computers. Sometimes it provides the funding for an individual attorney who wants to start up his or her own practice.
Microloans are helping thousands of small entrepreneurs like Amparo in the U.S., but the lenders are having a harder time. Just about all of them still depend on at least some support from foundations and other donors.
The big challenge in America has been getting to scale.
Jonathan Mordock studies microlending at NYU.
The microfinance institutions that have started up have managed to reach hundreds of borrowers, some thousands, but those are exceptions. But far from the scale that we see that's created this revolution, this explosion of microfinance overseas.
Mordock says lenders in the developing world make money by charging high interest rates. That doesn't fly here. He thinks microlending works best in the informal economy. That sector is relatively small in the U.S. The biggest problem, though, is there aren't as many borrowers because it's much harder to be an entrepreneur here.
There's regulation, there's marketing, there's all sorts of barriers that business owners need to overcome and opportunities to seize that are not so simple.
Grameen America's Chatri doesn't disagree, but along with its lending model, Grameen's brought its trademark idealism to the American scene. Chatri's convinced Grameen can change the way business works here, one tiny loan at a time. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Coming up, synthetic lawns are growing.
3 years ago, we were probably installing 2 jobs a day. Now we're probably installing 10 jobs a day and sometimes more.
But first, let's do the numbers. Those gloomy consumer confidence numbers dragged the markets down on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dipped 34 points, or 0.25%, to close at 11,807. The NASDAQ fell 17 points, or 0.75%, to close at 2,368. The S&P 500 lost 3 points, or 0.25%, to end the day at 1,314. United Parcel Service delivered a woeful profit forecast yesterday for the 2009 fiscal year, and today Brown's shares unloaded 6%. Dow Chemical announced a 25% price hike. Due to the spiraling cost of raw materials, its shares slipped 2.75%. Kroger shareholders were dancing in the aisles, so to speak. After the supermarket chain posted a strong first quarter profit, it fattened up 7%. A barrel of crude oil moved up to $136 and change. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat. Available now. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. The Commerce Department reports on new home sales for May. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee discusses the skyrocketing price of oil and its impact on the economy. And if you're comparison shopping at the pump, you've got about 167,000 gas stations in the U.S. to choose from, according to the Energy Information Administration. The EIA releases the full publication of its annual energy outlook. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Google is kicking off a new service as part of its Google Ad Planner site. Advertisers can answer questions about the particular kind of customer they want to target. And the Google site suggests places on the Internet that the particular audience is most likely to visit. Of course, the common denominator in all this is Google itself, which just happens to dominate online ad distribution. And that may not click with some advertisers. For more on this, we turn to Media Week senior editor Mike Shields. He follows online advertising trends. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Surprise, surprise, Google is expanding its reach again. So what's it doing this time?
Well, it looks like this time they want to get into the audience measurement space on the Internet, which is actually already an increasingly crowded one. You know, and of course, Google is going to give this new product away for free, but they want to kind of further cement their relationship with advertisers by getting involved with online media planning.
So how is what Google is doing in advertising now different than the companies that have already been offering these audience measurement techniques?
The two established players in the industry, Nielsen and Comscore, use panels. And that's really something that a lot of people in the industry have complained about for a long time. That's really an old way of conducting research. It kind of goes back to radio and TV. You have a small sample of users to represent the entire audience, which kind of feels archaic in this web space. You know, Google still has to release some details on this thing, but it sounds like this new product is going to use a lot more real data from the web, which I think should appeal to the agency world if they can stomach kind of getting this close to Google in terms of giving up a lot of their control there.
You mentioned that Google is going to be offering this service for free. What do they get out of it?
That's a good question. I mean, Google kind of always presents these things as we just want to help you out. We just want to be almost a friend of the community. You know, assuming that they get a fair amount of agencies using this thing, it kind of helps deepen their relationships with these folks. The question is this going to be 100% objective? Or are they going to use this to kind of influence ad spending a little more than they do? I'm sure they'll say that that's not going to be the case, but it's a little unclear exactly what they get out of it.
Yeah, there is a little bit of a possible conflict of interest here, it seems, in that Google is selling the advertising and then telling the advertisers what the audience is going to be.
Right. You know, they're kind of saying, we think these are the best sites to spend your dollars with. And by the way, we want to receive as many of your dollars as possible. I doubt that Google is going to recommend that you spend all their money with Google all the time. That would be a little bit too transparent or obvious here. But Google's got a lot of partners across the Internet. Are they going to favor those partners? I mean, hopefully they're going to be 100% objective. But it does raise questions.
They're already doing business with Google, though. It's just a question, I guess, of how far they're going to climb into bed with them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody's going to walk away from spending dollars with Google. Nobody can afford to take any kind of stance against them here. Do these agencies want to have Google know all kinds of things about their different aspects of their ad campaigns other than the dollars they spend with Google directly?
And what kind of things could they know?
Well, I suppose they could know, who their target is, what other elements of their media campaigns are out there, what are the sites they're spending dollars with. They might just know a little bit more about their plans than most clients would like.
But Google's famous slogan is "Don't be evil," right?
Right, right. And this is promised to help to make life better for people, not to have any kind of evil intent.
We shall see. Mike Shields is senior editor at Media Week. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
A stubborn drought is leaving a lot of people here in the West between a rock garden and a hard place. What's the alternative when it comes to taking care of a water-hungry lawn? Officials across the region have been experimenting with ways to reduce water demand, and some local governments are offering incentives to homeowners to cut the grass completely. That, coupled with growing awareness about conserving water, has been a boon for businesses that offer alternatives to traditional lawns. As Lenora Chu reports from Los Angeles, they aren't limited to planting cactuses.
When Denise Maynard and her husband Steve moved into their new home in El Segundo, California, they decided to redo the landscaping. He wanted a putting green. She wanted a low-maintenance yard. When they started shopping for options, they kept coming back to the same solution, a synthetic lawn.
We liked what we saw. In fact, we liked it so much, we ended up putting it in the backyard and in the front yard.
They installed 3,500 square feet of artificial grass with a 300-square-foot putting green by the pool. They also got a lawn able to withstand abuse from their two dogs. No more brown and yellow patches that often mar the grass of dog owners. Their lawn stays green all the time.
I've heard through a friend of a friend that one of our neighbors actually was very upset when we put the synthetic lawn in because it made her grass look so bad.
But outgreening the Joneses is not cheap. Dwayne Ruth of Sinlawn, the country's largest maker of artificial grass, installed the Maynard's lawn.
The front and back lawn with a putting green. It was about $30,000 to $35,000.
That's $7 to $12 a square foot for the standard polyethylene and nylon blend that from 10 feet away looks like the real thing. It cost about 4 times as much as planting natural grass. Despite the price tag, Ruth says business is booming.
You know, 3 years ago we were probably installing 2 jobs a day. Now we're probably installing 10 jobs a day and sometimes more.
Why? First, there's the feel-good aspect of not having to use precious water on your lawn, especially in drought-stricken parts of the country. Then there's the convenience factor, no mowing. Annie Costa is with the Association of Synthetic Grass Installers.
As people switch to low-maintenance products, they're saving time, they're saving money, they're saving water.
Costa says since 2000, the industry has grown nationwide by at least 30% a year. But synthetic grass does face a few hurdles. First of all, water is still relatively cheap, even in the West. So even though the average natural lawn drinks about 10 swimming pools full of water a year, there's little incentive to switch. Then there's the challenge of busting those myths about fake grass. That's where marketing consultant Hamilton Wallace comes in. He helps an Arizona synthetic grass company with its outreach strategy.
If you say artificial grass to a lot of people, the picture that they have in their mind is old indoor-outdoor carpet. It's real thin, it's ugly, and it's just not a real high-quality product at all.
So as a marketer, part of his job is putting potential customers in touch with satisfied ones.
Allowing their prospects to see and hear other people who had their same concerns talk about the process that they went through.
And when they hear that the average fake lawn pays for itself in 4 years, many get over the sticker shock. Back in Southern California, homeowner Charles Walsh watches workers hammer sheets of fake grass into a base of crushed rock. Walsh is a busy family man with a couple of dogs, a baby girl, and another one on the way. As workers fluff up his lawn with a power broom, a smile creeps across his face. On weekends, he'll be relaxing at the beach, not revving up a lawnmower.
Never owned one. Never want to. Never have to pay another gardener or anything. It's great.
And that, he says, he can take to the bank. In Los Angeles, I'm Lenora Chu for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, passengers flying from JFK to LAX tomorrow could be clicking away online thanks to GoGo. That's the name of the American Airlines' new broadband internet service offered by Aircell. It's free during the trial run. But in a few weeks, if all goes according to plan, you'll pay $12.95 to check your email. Of course, that's after you've already spent $15 to check your bag. And think of it this way. Now you can go online to check if your connecting flight is running as late as the flight you're on. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shaved off 34 points, a quarter of a percent. The Nasdaq dropped 17 points, about three quarters of a percent. And the S&P 500 lost 3 points, a quarter of a percent. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Next time, the heartbreaking business of international adoption.
If everything closes down and the bureaucracy gets heavy before I get a chance to bring a baby home, it'll just kill me to have all of this stuff in my house.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.